Well, I wonder what you're here for this morning. Legend tells that one day, the US President Franklin D. Roosevelt decided to find out if anyone was actually paying attention to anything that he was saying. As each person came up to him with an extended hand, he extended a hand and flashed a big smile and said, "I murdered my grandmother this morning." As he did so, he found that people automatically responded with comments such as, "Oh, how lovely, just keep doing the good work." Nobody actually listened to what he was saying, except for one foreign diplomat. When the president said, "I murdered my grandmother this morning," the diplomat leaned in and responded softly, "I'm sure she had it coming." Well, Roosevelt was testing the theory that very often we listen without hearing. And that can be especially true of us when it comes to the sermon slot. I mean, let's be honest, sermons have got a very bad reputation. You know, do most people come to church for the sermon? You'll find books like 101 Things to Do During a Dull Sermon, or Short, Sharp and Off the Point. And at one time, even the Church Times ran an advert for themselves with the cartoon of a choir boy being discovered by his vicar selling sermon survival kits, which basically included a cup of strong coffee and a copy of the Church Times to read instead. But sermons aren't just viewed as sleep-inducing, are they? If we feel that we're being sort of oppressed by someone verbally, and they're haranguing us, we might tell them to stop preaching at us. So if that's how we view sermons, then, well, why do we have them in church? Why do we have a sermon? So is that why we're here? And why are we going to spend the next few weeks looking at the first part of Jesus' Sermon on the Mount? Well, part of the reason is that if we're Christians, we can't escape from sermons and preaching, and we shouldn't do. When we look at the Bible, we find the word preaching or preachers 121 times. So God views preaching as an important way of communicating his message to us, because it's not in a negative sense that it's used. And perhaps never more obviously so than when we get to Matthew chapter 5, where we see in the Sermon on the Mount God communicating the important information on how we should live life in his kingdom. So contrary to what you might have been told, sermons are good things. Now interestingly, much of the Sermon on the Mount has really sort of filtered into everyday conversation. For example, you'll recognise these phrases: "Blessed are the peacemakers, your reward will be in heaven. The salt of the earth, don't put your light under a bushel. Every jot and or tittle, turn the other cheek, go the extra mile. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. You cannot serve both God and mammon. Take the speck out of your own eye. Cast pearl before swine." All those little phrases have slipped into everyday usage, and they come from the Sermon on the Mount. Not only that, but the best known of all of our prayers, which we've just said in our service not that long ago, the Lord's Prayer, also originates within this sermon. So perhaps we're beginning to see how influential the Sermon on the Mount has actually been over the last 2,000 years. But is it, when all said and done, just merely a collection of sort of wise sayings, some of which have made the transition from service to street? Well, no. The Sermon on the Mount is actually much, much more. So let's look a little bit more closely at this amazing section of Matthew's Gospel. So first of all, we need to ask ourselves, who is the Sermon on the Mount addressed to? When we open Matthew chapter 5, we read those first two verses that we had this morning. "Now, when he," that's Jesus, "saw the crowds, he went up on a mountainside and sat down. His disciples came to him, and he began to teach them." Now, granted, they're not the most gripping two verses, are they, in the Bible? But they do help us to understand who Jesus is talking to here. See, back in Matthew chapter 4, we read about Jesus calling his first disciples, Simon and Andrew. In these chapters, we are right at the beginning of Jesus' ministry. He's in the region of Capernaum, on the northwest shores of the Sea of Galilee, and his ministry is so electrifying that he's drawing large crowds of people to hear him do what? To hear him preach. But there's a time and a place for everything. And having called and gathered a group of close followers, Jesus needs to spend some concentrated time with them away from the crowds, So the Sermon on the Mount comes only 7 verses after that call to Simon and Andrew. Perhaps we get a better feel for things if we look at these couple of verses from Matthew 5 from the Message, a modern paraphrase. Puts it like this. When Jesus saw his ministry drawing huge crowds, he climbed a hillside. Those who were apprenticed to him, the committed, climbed with him. Arriving at a quiet place, he sat down and taught his climbing companions. This is what he said. See, the Sermon on the Mount is first and foremost teaching for Jesus' disciples, his apprentices, for those who follow him, for those who are committed to him already, his climbing companions, rather than those who are just sort of merely curious onlookers. Are you an apprentice of Jesus, a climbing companion? Well, if you are, then this is for you. Now, admittedly, by the time we come to the end of the Sermon on the Mount, in chapter 7, verse 28, we discover that all sorts of people have made it to the top and picked up on Jesus' teaching, because we read there, when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching. So, we start off with the inner group, the disciples, and then by the end, the crowds have come and gathered as well. But this teaching is primarily for those who already follow him, for those who want to know more about what it means to follow him. Michael Eaton, in his excellent book, puts it like this. The Sermon on the Mount is a challenge to Jesus' closest followers. Many of them just about to set out on a lifetime of ministry. People like Peter and James were gripped by it and never forgot it. Are we going to be the same? Secondly, we need to ask ourselves, what is the significance of Jesus teaching his disciples on a mountain? Perhaps all this seems a little extreme. After all, if we wanted some small group time, wouldn't we simply find a private room somewhere? Perhaps it would make more sense for this to have been the sermon in the conference room, the sermon in the lounge, the sermon on Zoom these days. But to understand the importance of what's going on here, we need to ask ourselves, what other biblical character can you think of who went up a mountain and returned with God's teaching on how to live life? Moses. Remember, Moses did that. Moses intercedes for God's people, goes up to Mount Sinai to receive God's law, and then pass it on to God's people as they moved from slavery to freedom. Now Moses' sort of greater and far superior successor also goes up a mountainside and gives God's law for God's kingdom to God's people as they prepare to move from the slavery of sin to the freedom of God's grace through the cross and the empty tomb. And that's because, as Don Carson reminds us, the key theme in the Sermon on the Mount is the kingdom of heaven, what the other New Testament writers call the kingdom of God. What it means, in other words, to live under the sovereignty of God. We've been thinking a lot, haven't we, over the last week or so, of what it means to live under the sovereignty of our Queen. It's really brought our royal family to the fore and reminded us of how precious they are to us. Well, the Sermon on the Mount reminds us what it means to live under the sovereignty of God. So, as God's people, we can expect to be gripped by Jesus' teaching about living under God's rule. But is this all a bit bitty? Thirdly, we need to consider what form the sermon took. Now, some sermons just don't grab the hearer. For example, the Reverend Dr. Robert South, while preaching one day in 1689, looked up from his notes to observe that his entire congregation, including the king, was fast asleep. Awkward. Appropriately mortified by his discovery, he interrupted his sermon to call out, "Lord Lauderdale, rouse yourself, your snoring shall wake his majesty." Which probably did the trick in actually waking everyone up. And if you read through Matthew chapters 5 to 7 at a steady pace, I mean, it might take you 10 to 15 minutes, but it would probably leave you a little bit puzzled, because to our ears it would sound somewhat disjointed as a sermon. You may well be left wondering why the crowds were so amazed at the end of it. And that's because you know, what we know as a sermon is the sort of thing that you can buy a book of sermons, can't you? From bookshops of Wesley, Spurgeon, Calvin. You know, you could download a copy of a sermon from online. You could listen to on a much more humble scale. You know, what the sermon is today. You can be able to listen to online from our website. Sermons, well, you know, they're several pages long. They start off with a joke. They have 3 points, all with the same letter, and they end with a challenge and application. That's what a sermon is. You can even read what was very probably a sermon in the book of Hebrews in the Bible. But what we have in the Sermon on the Mount doesn't look much like that sort of thing. And that's because it's not a written down sermon in the sense that if I gave you this, it would be. It's because these few chapters of Matthew's Gospel, they're probably Matthew's condensed version of a whole day or even a couple of days of Jesus' teaching. You try going to a weekend conference and condensing the whole thing in 2,500 words. Not easy. And this is, as John Stott puts it, the nearest thing to a manifesto that Jesus ever uttered. For it is his own description of what he wanted his followers to do. And this manifesto, this teaching, given over a day or two to his first year disciples at the beginning of their ministry, is awesomely electrifying. It's so sharp and so to the point that they certainly didn't need a book on how to survive a dull sermon as they listened to it and cherished it in their hearts. So far from being random sayings, Stott then helpfully breaks down the Sermon on the Mount, showing us that for a Christian it tackles distinct areas of life in the kingdom of heaven. It teaches us about a Christian's character, a Christian's influence, a Christian's righteousness, a Christian's piety, a Christian's ambition, a Christian's relationships, and a Christian's commitment. And we're going to be looking at those areas as we unpack Jesus' Sermon on the Mount and as we apply it to our lives. So what can we expect as we launch into the Sermon on the Mount? Well, it's also been described by one commentator, Michael Green, as the supreme jewel in the crown of Jesus' teaching. And that means that I hope we're going to come away with our Christian lives enriched, because we'll gather to listen and we'll go away amazed and inspired. I also hope that we'll be challenged. Sermon on the Mount is not the set of rules that we need to obey in order to enter the kingdom of heaven, but rather it draws us back to God's grace. It reminds us that these are Jesus' instructions on how to live life as one of his disciples in the light of new life through being born again through faith in him. I hope that we'll come like Simon and Andrew and the other disciples into Jesus' presence, and then as we work through the Sermon on the Mount, we'll become like Jesus' disciples, eager and committed apprentices and climbing companions. I pray that we'll watch as he sits down, that we'll lean forward in eager anticipation, and that we'll feel that excitement of Matthew chapter 5 verse 2, which leaves us wanting more. Arriving at a quiet place, Jesus sat down and taught his climbing companions. This is what he said. What was it that he said? You'll have to come back next week to find out. We're going to listen to our second hymn now. Drop, drop, slow tears.